Welcome to another edition of Lying on the Beach. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman Hess.
And today we've got a fascinating topic and one that's very timely. It's all about the pharmaceutical industry, which relates to the coronavirus and much more. We've got a great, an amazing author I'm going to introduce in a moment, but I want to point out that Lying on the Beach is powered by the Handle Stick, the must-have phone accessory that adds stylish jewelry and usability to your smartphone. Now on to our first guest, our exclusive guest for this podcast is Gerald Posner. He's an award-winning journalist who has written 12 books, including the Pulitzer Prize finalist Case Closed and multiple national bestsellers. Gerald has written for many national magazines and papers, including the New York Times, New Yorker. And Gerald's new book launching this week is Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. In Pharma, Gerald traces the heroes and villains of the trillion-dollar-a-year pharmaceutical industry and uncovers how corruption and reckless profiteering have led to deadly consequences. Pharma also uncovers the real story of the Sacklers, the family that became one of America's wealthiest from the success of the sales of OxyContin. And Gerald, thank you very much for joining us Lying on the Beach. We appreciate it.
Steve, Lois, great to be with you.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk about your book in a moment, but with the coronavirus being top of mind, I have to ask, are you confident the American pharmaceutical machine will create a vaccine in a timely fashion and keep it affordable for consumers? What's your take on that?
Well, I think they're going to get a vaccine in a speed record, like a year to year and a half. Normally, it's a five-year process. Now, affordable, that's the big question mark. Affordable and pharma, those two words don't often go together. So pharma pushes the limit as much as they can, even in a natural or international crisis, like a looming pandemic as coronavirus. You'd be surprised. I mean, I learned the history of this when I was doing the book, and that was even when we had the swine flu epidemic here in the United States in the 70s, there was a panic. They ordered the federal government a national inoculation program. Four pharma firms made 100 million doses of the vaccine. And then when the government said, give them to me, the firm said, no, not yet. We want to be sure we get a reasonable profit and no indemnity for any liability. And the government had to give in. So pharma's pulled tricks in the past. This time, I think the international outcry is too great. They won't be able to do it.
Really? You really think that that can actually make a difference, or they could just hold and say, look, we want X dollars and that's it? Or I mean, can the governments force them into it?
Because what the governments have learned is this: force them into it if they wait to do what the Ford administration did back in the 70s and wait till after the fact. You can't let them manufacture the doses for the vaccine when it's finally ready to go and it's ready to be deployed around the world. And without an agreement or a contract, then say after they've manufactured it, okay, fellows, now what's the price? You've got to have that going in. And there's a group in Norway that's trying to coordinate all the international vaccine sort of prices and everything else. Pharma's push back against them, but they need a concerted effort to say, look, you've got to cut your cost as low as possible. You can make a small amount of money on this, but we're going to be distributing this in the third world at your cost and no profit at all. And in other countries, you're going to make just a little bit of money. You're going to have to make the rest of your money on other drugs. And trust me, they make their money on other drugs times 10, especially in the United States. So as long as governments keep their eye on the ball, make sure they know before they start manufacturing the vaccines what they're going to charge for it.
And aren't we paying for some of the – sometimes they say, well, we put all the money into research. But more than likely, we just approved $8 billion. My guess is some of that money is going to go to them to help them do the research. We should get a break in the price because we're paying for the research.
Listen, this is one of the greatest things. I talk about this all the time in the book, and there's incident after incident of this. It will make people furious when they read this, and it's exactly what you just said, Steve. The use of public money, taxpayers' money, publicly funded NGOs, academics, and institutions that do the research, then the pharmaceutical companies take it, and then they patent it, which gives them a 17-year exclusive period to sell the drug at any price they set. So we're the only country on the planet that allows the drug companies unfettered power of pricing. They can set whatever price they want. So and the thing to remember, this is the statistic that sort of always boggles my mind. Since the 1930s, the National Institutes of Health, federally funded you know, publicly funded institution, has spent $900 billion of taxpayer money on research for medicines that pharmaceutical companies have then taken and made patents on and made money from. One of the best examples with the first HIV AIDS drugs. You'll remember AZT. It was the result of a government effort. It was an academic effort in San Francisco, publicly funded NIH effort. And then all of that research was taken by Burroughs, which had the underlying organic drug. Burroughs got the patent on it. The government actually tried to sue them to take the patent out for the public domain because it was considered that HIV and AIDS was such a big concern. And Burroughs won the suit, kept the patent, and made billions on that drug.
That's I'm furious right now. You've not only blood pressure medication because you've made my blood pressure.
which of course, pharma has a fix for. That's right.
Oh, my gosh. That's unbelievable.
So haven't
it's
we
so
learned our lesson? Haven't we learned our lesson in the past? And why has this not been fixed? Very naive question?
No, it's not a naive question at all. As a matter of fact, one of the things is I remember at the publisher, they asked me when I sent in this manuscript. They said, so, you know, should we be pitching just MSNBC? Should we pitch conservative channels like Fox? Is this just neither channel is going to like it? I said, you know what? It's not a political book, meaning that I castigate both parties in here. There have been opportunities over the years for the Republicans to fix things in here and for the Democrats to fix things. And why haven't they? It's not bad will. It's not that they don't want to, but they have both been too willing to accept big money from the pharmaceutical lobby over time for pressure on different drugs. And even I go into in the book, the great effort where we almost broke the back of this, believe it or not, was in the early 60s. There was this crusading Tennessee senator, Estes Gefauver. Many of your listeners may not have heard of him, but they certainly know the mafia. And he was famous for in the mid-50s. He was the first one to have hearings in the mafia. He had a fellow called Joe Valachi, who was an informer who told all about the mafia oaths and that. Well, after finishing with the mafia, he decided to go on to even a bigger conspiracies he viewed at the drug industry. He had all these hearings, and in 1962, he proposed this act which would have cut the patent period from 17 years down to 5 years, put restrictions on the pricing and all of this. The pharmaceutical industry came out, cut that up, and just about the time when it looked like it was dead, the thalidomide disaster hit, which was a drug taken by women mainly in Europe. While they were pregnant, right, for morning sickness. It turned out to lead to horrible defects in the babies. Everybody was up in arms. And what it resulted in is we passed a law that didn't focus on pricing, but focused on safety. So the FDA got more control over safety. We've never focused on pricing since. And pharma's made sure that we've stayed off of that.
Do you think the next election will change anything as far as pharma, or is going to continue to be the powerhouse that it's been in the past?
I think things will change. There's no question. I mean, but will we still be talking about high prices on drugs for the next four elections? Yes. You know, unless you wanted to go in and upend the industry entirely. Now, there are some fixes that aren't that difficult. And what I mean by that is there's a law that was passed in the 1980s. Called the Orphan Drug Act. The intent was good. As with a lot of laws, you know, the intent is good, and then it gets abused, and they find loopholes in it and whatever else. So the intent of this law was, hey, we have some genetic diseases, things that are such small groups of people being affected, under 200,000, that no pharmaceutical company, like infant cerebral palsy, this one syndrome that they can tie genetically, no one's focusing on making drugs because there's not enough money in it. So the law said, if you as a pharma company focus on these drugs, then we will subsidize your research. We'll help pay you all these tax credits. You'll get an extra 7-year exclusive selling period in all of this. So it's incentives to create for the small market. Great idea. Now, take it to 2020. And guess what? If you look at the top 10 most expensive drugs in the world, 8 are orphan drugs. How is that possible? They're the ones priced when you read a newspaper and it says $1 million a year, $1.5 million a year. They're doing it that. But then some companies have learned how to game the orphan drugs law. So here's a perfect example. We've all heard of Botox. Many listeners may use it. Botox for wrinkles, that drug you know, that's injected and sort of softens the look of wrinkles. So you think, okay, that's a drug that's not an orphan drug. What we don't know is actually it started as an orphan drug because Allergan, the company that has it, submitted it originally for two orphan illnesses related to involuntary eye muscle spasms. So that means that they got all of their original research for Botox subsidized essentially by the government with special exclusive periods to go ahead and prove it. Then a decade later, after they already had it on the market for 10 years, it was being prescribed off-label by doctors for wrinkles, they got it approved to treat another orphan disease, this thing called cervical dystonia. It's a condition marked in the neck and shoulder muscle spasms. Then they used that orphan drug to get more orphan drug approvals. They didn't get it approved for wrinkles until 10 or 12 years after it was originally out. So there's a case in which that law's been abused. They get it approved. They get all the money for the funding for the research from the government. They get all these special tax incentives, and then they use all of that to make it into a drug for millions of people. That was never the intent of the law, and that's happening time and time again. I talk about it in the book with repeated companies and repeated drugs.
Is there one drug company that's more abusive than all the others, or they're all the same? They're all bad.
Some are a little better. Merck for a long time had a reputation as being the company with the most researchers. They gave away a drug for river blindness to the third world when they couldn't afford it. They didn't have a drug that was recalled they were one of the few companies they used to say that Qantas was the only airline for a long time that never had a crash. Merck was the only company that didn't have a drug recalled until Vioxx. And then Vioxx sort of destroyed that reputation. Yeah. They hid some of the information about its danger. So they've all been tarred with that. When we say, are some worse than others? Some are overcharging or hiding information, and this happened in the 60s and 70s when they were targeting women with these stereotypical ads for anti-anxiety. Women were three times as likely to be the patients for Valium and for Librium, these drugs that were the first billion-dollar drugs in the business. And the oral contraceptives, drug companies, Cyril, hid the information about the increased risk of breast cancer with the high estrogen levels for years on that. So sometimes the drug companies, in seeking their profits, hide information that has real health consequences. That certainly happened in the opioid crisis, which I talk about a lot, in which people are dying at record numbers. I mean, more Americans have died from the opioid crisis than died in the Civil War. So there's a tragedy there that could have been prevented 10 times over.
Gerald, when you were researching your book, I have two questions. Were you like aghast at the things that you learned, you know, immediately, or was it hard to, you know, was it difficult to dig out?
No, time and time again, Lois, I was aghast at what I learned because I thought when I went into this, okay, pharma wears a black hat in the view of a lot of people. If you take a public opinion poll, they're somewhere hovering between used car salesmen and Congress in terms of lack of popularity. I knew that. And I don't think it's surprising. If I come back after a few years of research and all I have to report is, they overcharge, they try to get the most dollar for the buck, they hide bad effects at times, they send in money to Congress and they twist the arms of politicians, people will say, well, I have a feeling I know that. Well, it wasn't just that. It turns out to be, it's the history of the business. I mean, I take this all the way back to when before there was an FDA, when they had things called patent drugs. I mean, the industry grew up on addictive drugs. They grew up on morphine in the Civil War, which was the big drug that they sold when Lilly and Pfizer and others and Merck started their businesses. Heroin was a legal drug. A lot of people forget about that. Bayer, the same team at Bayer that invented aspirin, found heroin and put it on the market in 1900 and was marketed for babies, for cough, as a cure for morphine addiction. It's hard to imagine. Cocaine was a legal drug until 1914. So the industry got its start on these addictive items. And once they got past that, it was penicillin that turned the corner from them during World War II. Antibiotics in the 50s was a cash cow. And then in the 60s, it becomes Valium, Librium, and a series of others. They eventually get replaced by sort of antidepressants and heart pills and treatments for chronic conditions like diabetes, heart disease, hypertension. So there's always a new disease that the drug industry is moving into to grasp a hold of. And then, of course, the old addictive ones like the OxyContin and opioid painkillers, they come back again.
That's amazing. When you were doing your investigation, Was your life threatened in any way? I mean, did you feel like people were going to like, oh boy, this is going to be one of the worst things that's ever happened to the medical business?
No, I don't think that. And I guess that's why, Tricia, as you know, you two spoke to her and we worked together on our books. Neither of us have what I call that flashing yellow light warning signal. It's why I ended up in Afghanistan doing a story on, money laundering 10 years ago. And it's why
right.
we both went off to Southeast Asia and followed Chinese traffickers around the Golden Triangle on a heroin story, a book we did 30 years ago. So that's never the consideration. What I'm always worried about is, am I getting the full story? Have I missed something? And occasionally, you will both understand this, in a book that tries to cover the entire pharmaceutical business, you can only tell so much. And I'm also telling the backstory of what made the Sackler family, the people that own Purdue, the Sacklers. And then occasionally you'll come across somebody that looks like they would be a great little chapter if you could get into them, but you don't have the time for them. So there was a fellow who, an anesthesiologist who's known by Time Magazine, dubbed him the father of pain management. He was the guy who created the pain management business that eventually leads to all the opioid painkillers. All I could give him was one sentence in the book, and all I remember is a guy called John Bonica. He was an Italian-born former professional wrestler, carnival strongman, and light heavyweight world boxing anesthesiologist because he had chronic shoulder pain. And I love this idea of this, you know. So there are some great little side stories like that as well that you say, oh, yeah, I didn't know about that. I like the guy who was a carnival strongman and a wrestler who sort of led the pain re-involvement movement.
Why should the average American or European read your book? You know, I want to give our listeners a reason why like this is a must.
Because you're going to be a smarter consumer on a lot of different things. I'll give you the easiest one. There's a section in there that talks about something called the gag law. And that is, in the United States, if you go into American consumers, this is critical. You walk into a pharmacy, you give them your insurance card, you have a prescription, your copay on that prescription is $40. Fine. You pay it, you leave with your prescription. The pharmacist is not allowed in 39 states to tell you if it would have been cheaper if you had paid a cash price. So if it had only been $8, if you walked in with no insurance, which believe
right.
it or not, it can happen, then you walk out paying the higher copay. It's a disgrace. The Trump administration is thinking of passing a law to make it a federal law. They haven't yet. But it's a disgrace that you can still walk out of a pharmacy paying a higher price because the pharmacist who knows the cheaper price can't tell you that. And you know why that is? Because the pharmaceutical companies have built it in with a middleman called these pharmacy benefit managers, these companies like Medco and others. They're multi-billion dollar companies. They get rebates from the pharma companies to under certain insurance plans to direct you to drugs so that you take those, they take the rebates, you take the drug and pay the higher copay. It's all about money in the end. You read this book, and at least you're not going to go to a pharmacy in the end and pay more than you should.
Is your book too complicated for the average person?
Well, there are two parts of it. Here's what I call the uncomplicated part. The uncomplicated part is the straight story. You read the straight story, you skip the footnotes at the bottom of the page, and you skip the source notes, which are 300 pages at the back of the book. And all of a sudden, it becomes a 400-page easy read and a great story about a family, the Sacklers, that if anybody has seen Mad Men or Succession, you understand a dynastic family that's very dysfunctional, that sort of goes from rags to riches. You're talking about Brooklyn kids who had absolutely nothing and were banned from going to New York University for medical school because the quota for Jews had been filled, and end up being a $14 billion family, one of the wealthiest around. I uncover the documents in the FBI that shows they were card-carrying members of the Communist Party, investigated by the FBI, even for espionage. It's an amazing story. And when you're reading all of that at the same time, you're learning about the drug business. So that's what I call the easy part of the read.
Right.
For those who want to go to medical school or are interested in the details, read the footnotes and read the source notes, and then it becomes a more intense book.
Gerald, did you have to wait to see, because there's a trial that just came up and the Sacklers had to pay some damages and whatnot. Is that included in this book, or did you
get it is included.
That?
No, I had information, as a matter of fact, through December, so I talk all about the bankruptcy. I've got new information from people that I spoke to who had worked for Purdue Pharma, who spoke to me off the record. There's a story in there. There's a chapter called You Messed with the Wrong Mother, and I'll tell you that Wired magazine is about to do This week, as the book comes out, First Serial Rights, and they are having that chapter as their excerpt. It's an astonishing story. It's a little mini movie on its own of a woman who lost her daughter. She's a part-time nurse, and she decided that something's not right. How did my daughter who had back pain die of OxyContin? This happens in 2001. So she makes it her life's mission to find out, and she chases Purdue Pharma. This is sort of like an Aaron Brockovich with a real reason. She's there at every corner. She gets the FDA to take action against them. They are putting out rumors that her daughter was an addict, which wasn't true. And she says to one of the executives, "You messed with the wrong mother." And at the sentencing trial for some of the executives back in 2007, she gives a talk to the judge. She's asked to make an impact statement. And she said, "I'm going to be there. I know you are going to put out another drug. You're going to keep pushing these. And every time you do, you're going to have to look over your shoulder because I'm going to be there chasing you." That's a story that will tell you everything else about the opioid crisis is in that chapter in terms of what is a moving personal story. It brings it down to one person's mission and makes it very real.
Has anyone bought the film rights to that chapter?
No, not yet. But my agent for film thinks that that is the chapter they're probably going to come straight after.
I think so. Sounds great.
Gerald, what kind of expectations do you have for the book? Who do you think is going to be the target audiences?
Well, I think the target audience, you know, the writers always expect too large a target audience, but the target audience that I think of is sort of any of us who have got a prescription and take a pill. We know what the system is like. We've been told by a doctor when we've gone into an office, think of this. Somebody says to you, your blood pressure is too high or your cholesterol is too high. I'd like you on a statin. And then they tell us which statin they think is best for us. And we're not quite sure if they're telling us that statin because they happen to like the drug being better than everything else or because the rep for that company has a good relationship with them or took them out for a big dinner or they're on the speakers bureau for the company and they're getting $50,000 a year. They're going down to vacations in Bermuda. And here's the thing that's interesting is that one of the most frustrating parts is, and everybody who has dealt with doctors and prescriptions should think about this. This is the only business in which the people who are being sold to, which are doctors, yeah, we have the commercials on TV, but we can only go and ask a doctor about the drug. We can't write the prescription. So the pharma companies are selling to doctors for them to write the prescriptions to us. So they are selling to a middle person who doesn't know the price in most cases. When that doctor gives you the prescription for a statin, an antidepressant, a muscle relaxant, whatever else, they don't actually know what you're going to pay. They may know what the list price is if you even bother to look it up, but they certainly don't know what your plan, your insurance plan is going to charge you. So the doctors are making these decisions not based on price, but just based on their relationship with the drug companies in many instances. And then you as the consumer have to go out and fend for yourself. It's a really unusual business that way.
I just don't understand how the pharmaceutical, what the reaction of the pharmaceutical industry is going to be when people get educated through your book. And will you need bodyguards?
Well, I think that some of the reaction I saw the other day. So I did a New York Times op-ed in which I said that the pharmaceutical companies are a speed bump on the road to developing vaccines for coronavirus because of their insistence on profits and no liability from any injuries.
Right.
And I saw that immediately I had a letter back from a pharma executive at Pfizer that said, oh, by the way, we did great work and gave away a lot of vaccine when it came to Ebola in 2014. So they cited their good work. And, you know, this charge that we're always after profit is an old charge and it's overdone. I think that's what you're going to hear. They're going to say, oh, we've been told that all the time. They're going to find every instance in which they have given away drugs, subsidized a program, helped somebody else. Look, there's no question drugs save lives. I understand that. And a lot of them have very good intents and they have done good things. But there's no question also, this is a business that affects our health each and every day. There are plenty of bad characters that have played out across the board on this. So I discuss both of them as the bad ones you remember in the end, unfortunately.
And let me take a moment.
Yeah, go ahead.
Take a moment right now. I'm going to interrupt this because we have to pay our bill too, just like pharma does. And that goes back to Handlestick. It's the must-have phone accessory that adds stylish jewelry and usability to your smartphone. Handlestick attaches directly to the back of your existing smartphone case or directly to the phone itself, so you don't have to switch cases. Handle utilizes a brace system that lets you effortlessly grip your phone when speaking, texting, taking selfies. It makes it feel like the phone is floating in your hand. Handle allows for complete one-handed use of the phone and frees up the other hand for multitasking. Handle Stick is also a kickstand that lets you set up your phone either in landscape or portrait modes. And yes, you can wirelessly charge through the Handle Stick. It comes in 40-plus styles, including animal prints, lots of colors, fun glitter, sophisticated carbon fiber patterns. The Handle Stick starts at just, get this, $10. Check it out at Handle, H-A-N-D-L, newyork.com. So that New York is spelled out. That's HandleNewYork.com. Okay, so
thank
back
you.
To
Gerald, I want to ask you a question. Steve and I were talking before the broadcast. I think we read something or another doctor told us that there are a lot of meds that are coming from China now that could be infected that we all take for blood pressure, diabetes, etc. What do you know about that, and how does that, you know, affect what's going on in the current events area?
Yeah, I mean, there are two things. Even before the coronavirus, I will tell you, if you want to get scared, and I talk about this in the book, you just have to go on to, there's a FDA website that shows recalls, not recalls that are so large that they make the daily headlines. Like they've had recalls of a blood pressure pill recently because they were afraid that it might have some traces of a cancer-causing item. But smaller recalls where lots of drugs will be recalled that are manufactured in India or in China or in another country in which there were impurities, there was arsenic found, whatever else. The FDA has done these spot checks and they pull them back. Now, there's a whole problem with this. The FDA has the right to send inspectors to any foreign plant that's manufacturing generic drugs or brand name drugs, but mostly they're generics that come into the United States. They don't have the resources for it. They can't. They're examining plants in the United States once every 2 years. They're getting abroad to look at 10 or 15%. So there's always been a problem with the quality of the drugs coming in. You have to sort of cross your finger and hope that they're good. But in this case, now coronavirus adds a different policy into it, a different threat. That is that the factories themselves that are manufacturing the drugs are closed up in many instances. People can't go to work. The numbers allowed into the work factories have been reduced. The numbers in a space can't be as many. So therefore, the production has fallen off in some cases by 80%. We probably are about 6 to 8 weeks away from what I call the first panicky shortages of some generic drugs in things like blood pressure, in possibly that whole area of statins and that. And if that starts to happen, right now we see people hoarding water and, disinfectants. If they start trying to hoard drugs, it's going to be another scary part. And that's part of the supply chain. Nothing we can do about it.
Oh, my God. That is so scary. I mean, how did your book come out exactly at this time?
Well, okay,
were
so
you,
the great...
Were you behind the coronavirus?
Yeah, that's exactly right. No. I'm ready for some conspiracy person to say that. And as a matter of fact, I don't know if you both have seen this. Have you seen... Well, I'm going to say, on timing in books, there was a book put out years ago by a historian, Jürgen, on the history of oil. I think it was called The Price. And it's a long treatise on oil. And the expectations for it weren't that high. He was 3 years late in turning it in. He turned it in during the first Gulf War. When we went to the war and everybody was interested in oil, it became a big bestseller. So sometimes you get lucky with timing because events are taking place in the world that you have no control over. I saw a video that went viral that shows somebody standing in front of a supermarket and looking at cans of Lysol and disinfectants, takes one of the cans, turns it around and says, look at this. On the back, it says effective against human coronavirus. How is that possible? He said that they were already selling this as a disinfectant before anyone heard of the coronavirus. So that means it's a conspiracy, that somebody must have already planned this. Companies were selling the products before we even knew it was around. What actually happens is this new bug, the COVID-19, is a new virus, but it is part of the coronavirus family. So there were two others, MERS and SARS. So when it says human coronavirus, it's effective against the other forms that have already been out. Now, this one will be one of those effective, but people take that to mean, a conspiracy. It must have been manufactured. This one came from Mother Nature. That's where microbes come. And unfortunately, microbes can sometimes be very, very nasty.
Amazing. Steve, I think that's a wrap. Right?
I agree. I think we really covered it. I know I'm definitely going to put Pharma on my list of books to read. What's the chapter that would make that great movie? Which chapter is it? Do you know what I'm
saying? Oh, yeah, it is. Let me tell you, I should, you know, how is it possible, Steve, that I don't know that chapter number? It's called, of course, You Messed with the Wrong Mother, and I'm going to tell you it is 47.
Chapter 47, and the movie will be called... Wrong Mother.
Mother, that's right. And 51 is the coming pandemic. So, you know.
Okay, those are two chapters.
But, you know, so I did a good job of staying on Dog Bites, Man Bites Dog.
Wait a minute, I have another question to ask you. How did a person, actually, I ordered it on Audible. I ordered it on an ebook. I ordered the hardcover. I don't get, Ellie wants you, of course, signing everything, but I don't know how anybody could read. You know, I'm going to be listening to this book March 10th when the book comes out, and we, of course, this podcast doesn't go out before. But how does somebody read? I mean, were you participating in that at all?
No, I don't know how they read it. As a matter of fact, I can't wait to listen to it myself because I haven't heard it. And I was thinking, I'm not sure when they read a book that has footnotes and endnotes, what do? They leave out, I guess, all the source notes.
I don't know the answer to that yet.
I think the answer is they leave that stuff out because I've had other books with source information. It's usually not included in the Audible part. At least that's my experience.
Yeah, it must be. And, you know, look, I worry the publisher, they weren't looking for a book this large. You know, they were hoping I would turn in a 400-page book. And when I turned it in this large, I'm waiting for them to come back and say, okay, nice work, Posner. Good research. Now let's cut it down to a readable size. All right.
That's what you told me would happen. Yes.
Yeah. Right. And instead, my editor said, you know, like, damn it, I like it. It's good. Yeah. We tried to squeeze it down. We did cut out 20,000 words here or there or things like that. But on the whole, you know, no one has attempted to tell the entire history of the American pharmaceutical industry and tell the opioid story and everything else. So it was an ambitious book. I get it. Next book, I don't know what it is, but it'll be 400 pages.
Okay. Well, we're holding it to that. Gerald, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. And again, the book's title is
Pharma.
The subtitle is
Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America.
Can't forget that. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman Hess.
And we have been Lying on the Beach. So long, everybody.
Thank you.